Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at the League of Education Voters. Washington Superintendent of Public Instruction Chris Rakedaw was born and raised in Snohomish, the youngest of eight children. He graduated summa cum laude from Washington State University with a bachelor's degree in social studies and earned a master's degree in public administration from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He coached both youth and adult soccer for several years, volunteered as a local city planning commissioner, and served as a trustee for the College Spark Washington Foundation for 6 years. His professional career has been devoted to public education. Chris has worked as the high school history teacher, local school board member, state legislator, and budget and education policy executive for our state's community and technical college system. In November 2016, Chris was elected as Washington's 16th state superintendent. Chris and his wife, Kim, live in historic Tumwater with their two children, Carter and Kennedy. Chris, congratulations. It's interesting times, and I'm really curious, what are your priorities for your first 100 days now that you've been on the job for almost a month?
Thank you so much for having me once again. It's a great opportunity here to talk with you all and your listeners. Yeah, so our first priorities are, as you can imagine, pretty complex, and they're all in parallel time. One is to assess the organization and to really just understand its culture and let it sort of embrace us in many ways. This is an amazing place. There's talent all over the place. But we had to bring in our own leadership team. So we've probably altered or moved 9 or 10 of the 19 cabinet positions already. And there's possibilities that there's going to be a few other moving parts. And so getting the talent right from our perspectives that aligns with our interests and long-term leadership objectives of the organization are very important. The parallel, of course, is you're doing that in the middle of a legislative session where we're also very externally facing trying to help policymakers and budget writers on both sides of the political aisle in both chambers to get to a place that actually supports kids in school districts and overall sort of fairness and equity issues. So the lens we keep bringing to every concept they put forward is it going to change outcomes for students? Is it going to create more equity, more fairness? And that can be everything in our perspective from student achievement for students of color to equity with respect to the tax code and property taxes and levies. And so we're not shy to be in some conversations that are both policy focused as well as budget and tax focused. But those are two of our big tasks. Get this place kind of re-engineered to our value set and get everyone elevated here in terms of their ability to really own their content and be more visible on the Hill, and then to help policymakers get to the right spot.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on when it comes to both equity in terms of taxes and equity in terms of students of color. Obviously, right now is an exciting time because we just saw a plan come from the Senate that talked about ways of addressing some of these issues, especially in the McCleary education funding lawsuit landscape. And then we saw the governor's plan come out in December, and we've just seen a House plan come by. And I'm curious, what do you like from each plan?
Well, I'll start with a big picture perspective, and that is even a year ago, I heard lots of members say, I'm not even sure I want to validate the court, and I'm not sure why we need to do this, and almost all of that has dissipated. The good news about the governor's approach, the Senate approach, the House approach is everyone is acknowledging that the big thing we have to do is actually address funding of our schools, and parallel to that is doing a better job for our students. So the sort of fresh breath of all this is that the governor launched this with a very comprehensive plan. He pays for it, which, to be honest with you, he's the only one of the three plans that also articulates how to fully pay for it. So it's really balanced. It would absolutely change the game for students. It does focus more resources on communities that need it. There's a tax fairness element to it, but there's also a recognition we need to add resources to the system. So I think the governor just launched a tremendous start for everybody. And I stood with him and said that. The Senate's approach obviously works very hard to try to reimagine how we send dollars to districts. They move from our prototypical school model to a per student model. Lots of other states do this. The strength of it, if it's done well, is it really does target resources in communities that need it most. And you can pick different levers, poverty, homelessness, ELL. You can do lots of things in the policy world and really make that effective. Its shortcoming, of course, is that it really doesn't add additional dollars. It does a bunch of tax shifting. There is some need to do some of that. There's no question. But I have a hard time being anything but honest with them about saying, if all you do is move where the money comes from, which there's some need to do that, you won't get the student outcome differences that we expect. And so I think it's more than just threading the needle for the court. I think it's also saying what would change outcomes for students. So then enter the House plan. which does a little bit of all that. It keeps the prototypical school model like the governor. It certainly expects to spend a lot more resources, and that would be a very good thing for student outcomes. But it also is sensitive, I think, to needing to add additional lap dollars and additional CTE dollars and additional places. They got to figure out how to pay for it, of course. And so that's the big challenge for them and obviously for everybody in the end. But every plan is focused on trying to do what is right for students, and I think that's the best thing that we can do here. There's a lot of politics in every plan, as you can expect in January and February, and lots of that will sort of evaporate as we get more focused. But we've never had this much concentration of energy this early in session, so they are all to be congratulated for being in the game right now.
Well, let's talk about gaps for a minute, because that's something that I think is a huge landscape element of education here in Washington. One thing you've said, it was actually right in this room about a week ago, and I was very impressed. You said, the only metric that you are really focused on is 100% graduation for every Washington student with college or post-secondary readiness, and everything else is just an indicator. We have these gaps, of course, between students of color and their white peers. There's pockets of success here and there, but how do you think we could motivate all districts to address the problem?
Yeah, so this is the challenge of our time, and I'm very serious about us focusing on the end goal that we all have, which is 100% on-time graduation with a quality diploma, and that means multiple pathways, by the way, and maybe we can spend some time acknowledging that that's not a university-ready pathway for every student. It is some great opportunity post-secondary here, apprenticeship, CTCs, technical schools, military, universities, etc. The want for us to do that requires us to then design backwards what would that look like. And the first thing I say every time I insist on 100% graduation is the singular focus is, let's be honest, the 21% who are not graduating on time or at all look very different than the 79% who are. You cannot ignore the disproportionate impact on students who live in poverty, students of color, our foster youth, our LGBTQ youth. You can kind of go through the data and say, wow, these are really measurable populations, and if we put our dollars to work a little differently, we could actually have massive impact here. And so that brings us full circle to all of those plans we just talked about. They should all invest more dollars. We are a state very wealthy, disproportionately investing very little in our public school system based on a Rutgers study that I've pushed out. But when you do that, don't just pile it into the existing formulas and say, hey, all it takes is more money. It does take more, but it also takes us being intentional in different ways. And that's the strength so far of everyone's plan. Even though they do it very differently, they all acknowledge that it is finally time to invest differently.
What do you think is the cause of achievement gaps in the K-12 population?
Well, it's multiple factors. Obviously, we have a funding system in the state that is episodic, in that if you go back to 1889, there's these waves where the state does its equitable share, and then during times of crisis, they give it back to local communities where wealthy communities can do lots and low-income communities can't do as much. Mm-hmm. And we've had multiple waves of this, and so that crested again recently when the court said, ah, hey, we did it again, now get back and fix it. So how we fund schools is a contribution. Our inability to truly address income inequality is real here. Yeah. And it's not just income, it's the opportunity that comes from having resources. People who live, you know, with means can go get tutors, can go get supplemental support, can get basic health and vision and all the stuff that contributes to student success. If you're in poverty, those things are not given. Mm-hmm. And so all the interventions that a school can do in 7 hours may not be enough to overcome some big barriers in the 17 hours where we don't have the child. It's part of why I say it's not going to be enough to just move the deck chairs around a little bit. Partly we have to. But if you do that or even invest more in public schools at the expense of tearing down social safety net programs, you will not ultimately achieve the goal of closing gaps and graduating more. So that's a hard message for some people, because we're saying you do have to invest more, you have to do it more equitable ways, and you have to focus on populations that need support. And oh, by the way, don't do it by carving up all the things they need in their private lives for support. Mm-hmm. And then there's just flat out institutional barriers, right? We have made it difficult for some students, particularly students of color over time, to participate equally. because we norm our processes and our systems on a big cultural bias, because let's face it, virtually everyone in our system is white. They almost all have bachelor's or master's degrees, right? So we all are sort of cloned into education in a similar way. And so part of breaking this thing down long-term is having very intentional practices of getting a more diverse teaching force, administrators, school board members. It goes from those who are making the policy all the way to those who are really cleaning and taking care of our schools. We have to diversify. So all of those become success factors if we focus on them, which is why you got to deploy the money a little differently.
Exactly.
Yeah, finding that diversity of staff, of certainly of educators, is the trick. What do you think is the best way to diversify our educator workforce?
Well, there's macro strategies and micro, and the macro, if I can start with, again, the same Rutgers study, which we've pushed out, makes it abundantly clear that in terms of market competitiveness, we're just not very competitive for young people to teach. We are in a booming economy, not in every county, clearly, but the central Puget Sound is such a magnet for economic opportunity that if you're a young person, particularly a young person of color, and you say, I'm thinking about teaching, and you walk up to that starting salary and you do even projections on reasonable growth in that system, it will always be inferior to the private marketplace. So not surprisingly, they want to get into software and they want to get into engineering and they want to get into some other things. So the macro solution is a recognition that, and again, objectively from the data, we are an F compared to other states about what we invest back in our educators. But then there are micro solutions, which means really intentional practices in recruiting educators, supporting them when they're there, bringing back conditional scholarships, or I've said, just make it absolutely free to go to college with state dollars, because an objective of the system should be to diversify to get better results. These are the kinds of risk-taking activities we'll have to do, and we had baby steps like this before, and then in the recession, a lot of those conditional scholarships and those programs kind of got torn down. You have to put them back in place and then sustain them. So complex task, big picture, get compensation right and recruit, and micro picture is be very intentional about the work, create the financial incentives, reward school districts who do the right thing. They should not be punished by going out there and taking risk and finding folks who are more diverse and finding folks who took alternative pathways to this work. They should be rewarded for that.
Let's talk about alternative pathways. You made a reference to it a little bit earlier. And you've been a proponent of career technical education, or CTE, for quite some time. How can you build a system of career technical education that will allow kids to have reliable access to meaningful coursework that has rigor and will actually take them somewhere where they want to go?
You got to start by designing backwards. If you can imagine a world where 100% of our kids graduate, but you recognize they're not all going to head to a university and they're, or they're not all going to head into the workforce, if you imagine them being as diverse in their next step as they are and who they are as people, then you say, okay, we got to figure out ways within our 24-credit diploma, for example, so that students get rigorous coursework and get to the end of that thing with a meaningful next step. It's all about growth, right? Which is our new accountability framework, as we've left No Child Left Behind and are moving towards the Every Student Succeeds Act. We dial up growth as this thing that's important to us. So it's not this absolute benchmark where every kid 18 years after birth is exactly at the same spot. It's recognizing that they're moving at different paces. We can do that without lowering quality, without lowering rigor, with still having meaningful assessments. But to be honest with you, you have to build a flexible enough 24-credit diploma that students can actually create with some big decisions, a CTE pathway, right? Or a university pathway, or a community college pathway, or a straight-to-work pathway. Our credit flexibility needs a little help. There's some electives in there. There's some room to pick a pathway and do some different things. It's probably going to need a little more help. And then to be brutally honest with you, I don't think we'll ever see those flexible pathways exercised in the real world until you de-link a very high-stakes test from graduation. And I know that causes some people some risk, but only three other states are doing this right now. The reason I say that is most rational parents and rational counselors will say this is a very academic-heavy assessment that we're using. It is a gatekeeper to graduation for today's sophomores. So you can imagine how they're guiding students in their coursework. They're saying stick with very traditional college prep sorts of courses, that's your highest probability of passing the test. Mm-hmm. So when you manage to attest, you're actually kind of inadvertently telling every student, well, your 24 credits is pretty much set in stone, and it all looks a lot like you're headed to a university. Mm-hmm. If you can de-link the test and use it for its proper purpose, which is measuring system progress and identifying gaps for students, then all of a sudden it is not a big risk for a student to say, I really want to go in and be a vet tech or an aerospace machinist, or I want to do something in construction trades. They could then build a course sequence that says, I'm going to get really good skills. I'm going to take that assessment because I should demonstrate quantitative reasoning and all of the standards. But it's not the end of my life if I don't make it through this high stakes test. That's the world we should be living in.
To maintain the rigor and to make sure that kids are actually going where they want to go, do you see investing in more guidance counselors to really make sure that they're on a path that will take them somewhere meaningful?
It's certainly about more counselors and lots of other investments. And it's not just more counselors, but it's giving them the professional development so that the bias that they come with, which again is a very baccalaureate and master's degree orientation, they have to truly appreciate these pathways for students. And our counselors are amazing, but we all have implicit bias. And so you got to do some professional development. I was just talking with some business leaders yesterday who said, we'd really like teachers and counselors in the summer as part of their requirement to keep educating themselves and getting credits and clock hours. Come to our businesses. We want to put them on tours of factories, and we want to show them how the things they are teaching apply to our world. And I thought, this is the future, right? I mean, our counselors would be really excited to put students in these trades if they could see it more often. And that's certainly a big part of this, is our counselor workforce. And then it's making sure that our courses are infused with really high standards. And we can do that. A great construction trades program can have very powerful applied geometry. Programs leading students to small business ownership can have really rigorous statistics, right? Real world stuff, real world quantitative reasoning that isn't necessarily preparing them for college level calculus pathways. Mm-hmm. When we get that right, the world is open to every student.
Some of the biggest challenges are just making sure that we're not tracking students. We're saying, okay, you over there, you should go this way, and you over there should go that way, and making sure that we really are looking at a level playing field. Would professional development tackle that situation, or do you think there's another approach?
Well, PD would help, and then some very clear policy statutes that require us to braid programs. In other words, I should be able to say to you, hey, I'm headed to the UW, and I take my courses. And when I change my mind and I decide that, actually, I want to go be a fabricator for a while and maybe I'll come back, my credit should come that direction. It should work. Subsequently, the student who starts 8th or 9th grade and says, I really want to be a vet tech, and so they go down this path. When they decide that they want to instead head off to Central Washington University or Western, they should have gotten the meaningful standards in their early grades, for example, that they're ready to hit that traditional Algebra 2 pre-calc track, right? So it's about pathways that braid, that allow students to move back and forth. We were terrible at this 30 years ago, and we've only slowly gotten better at allowing this to happen. Having come from the community technical college system, I can tell you for the last 10 years, it's sort of been our obsession, is this ability for students to pick pathways, but then to move back and forth. The analogy was always sort of the subway. You should be able to go, get off for a while, work, come back, and keep going. We got to get better at this in school. Unfortunately, without more resources, districts will do what is natural, which is simplify their offerings, put lots of students in a classroom. I mean, they will try to deliver the most instruction that they can for the money they have. And so additional investments actually does help CTE. When you have the money you need, you say, okay, I will actually mount that program, and I will tolerate only having 14 or 15 students in that class because I can afford it. In a world where you are financially strapped, you cannot afford to put on those low enrollment courses. So what do? You put everyone in traditional pathways. A third-year student say, I am bored to tears, and graduation rates don't move.
It sounds like you've certainly got your work cut out for you. Now that you've been on the job for almost a month, what is your favorite part? What do you like most about being here?
The people. OSPI is just an amazing place. We have a little over 400 folks, and it's a very complicated environment in K-12, of course, because we have policymakers who have needs, and we want to be good customer support. We have our districts. We have other folks in this arena with us, the Student Achievement Council, the State Board of Ed, the Educator Standards Board. We all have to have good partnerships, and I think there's a need to clarify some roles, quite frankly, this session and next session. But really remarkable people, passionate about public education. It's getting them in the right spots and then letting them shine. And that's something I take pride in doing for the last 20 years of my career. And I'm back in a position on the executive branch of government and not the legislative branch where I can make more of that happen. And I love it.
Chris Rakedahl is the Superintendent of Public Instruction. Chris, thank you so much for letting me drop in.
Thank you so much.